You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And this week on Dear Science, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Castor.
And a foggy afternoon it is.
The sky tower disappeared this morning.
Yeah, I couldn't see my train tracks on my walk-in. Everything seems to be out of view. And what?
That sounds like a good first line for a song, man.
Yeah.
Everything seems to be out of view.
It's also a good line to segue into our first story about something that was out of view a long time ago, maybe as long as you can get, really.
Well, indeed. The Big Bang.
Right.
As they call it. And that was, you know, supposedly the start of everything. And in fact, that term, the phrase the Big Bang, was first coined by a guy called Fred Hoyle, later Sir Fred Hoyle, in 1949 on a BBC radio broadcast. So he was an astronomer. Who actually didn't believe in the Big Bang, I think. Because, you know, there's various sort of theories out there. But the Big Bang seems to be the one that agrees with our observations the best.
You just called it that off the cuff?
I don't know, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
Interesting.
Don't know. But, you know, for those of you not familiar with what the Big Bang is, so it's essentially the beginning of the universe. And it's a moment when space and time and matter came into existence, you know, easy as that.
Yeah, everything we need, really.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, very, very quickly after that moment, the universe rapidly started to expand. And so this whole Big Bang idea does explain the idea of the expanding universe. We know that the universe is expanding, so it explains that. But in order to explain some of the other sort of features of the universe, it needs a thing called dark energy to be sort of proposed. And also, and this seems to be the big problem, is that right at the start, right at the point of the Big Bang, you have this thing called a singularity. And a singularity is a point of infinite density where the laws of physics actually break down.
It seems a bit inconvenient.
Well, you know, when your laws break down, then they're not laws anymore.
Right.
And so we have a bit of a problem there, possibly. So this is what got workers in Spain and India and the UK into the picture, and they thought, right, is there a better way that we can describe the start of the universe rather than the Big Bang? And so they've come up with a new model of how they think the universe began, and it doesn't require this whole idea of a singularity, and it doesn't require this whole thing of proposing this dark energy stuff, okay? And what they started off with was that they imagine this really, really, really dense, like ridiculously dense matter, and how that collapses into itself under the influence of gravity. And that's what happens. That's how black holes are basically formed.
Right.
That you get this very, very massive species that just collapses under gravity and just, you know, forms this thing called a black hole. And what they were saying was that this singularity is a product of what we call classical physics, okay? And we're in the realm of quantum physics now. So quantum physics explains things just way better than classical
right.
physics does. So singularities are a product of classical physics. So when you're talking about black holes and stuff like that, you're sort of talking in terms of, not of black holes, but of the Big Bang. You're sort of talking in terms of classical physics, which really, they say, doesn't apply. So what they say is that as you've got this massive, massive, massively dense object falling in on itself, it gets to a point where it's not allowed to go any further.
Can't go in anymore.
Well, because of this thing called the quantum exclusion principle.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Or if you've done sort of chemistry, you'll know it as the Pauli exclusion principle, basically saying that particles can't occupy the same state in the same position and stuff, and it's all
two things can't be in the same place at the same time.
Kind of like that. And that's what's going to happen in a singularity. So what they're saying is, no, it never gets to this point where you require a singularity. It gets to a point and then it bounces.
Yeah,
okay, so it's falling in on itself, and then it gets to this point where quantum physics won't let it go
sort
any further.
Sort of rubber bands out.
And so, exactly. Yeah. And so it just bang, and away it goes. And this is what they say happens. So they're talking about not so much a big bang, but a big bounce.
Mm. Yeah.
Which you know, it's alliterative. It's quite good.
Yeah, it sounds quite fun as well.
And importantly, their theory makes testable predictions, which is one of the big things of science. Mm. You know, they say that this should happen. Or the theory says that this should happen. Does it actually happen? Is this what we see? And the answer is yes. So what they are finding is that, yes, it explains the whole expansion of the universe sort of thing. And now this is the bit that I just don't understand, okay? Which, well, lots of it that I don't understand, let's say. But it predicts that the universe shouldn't be flat.
Ooh.
Okay, now here's a weird thing. How is a three-dimensional object flat?
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's one for the Flat Earth Society.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I don't get this, but apparently there's a space mission at the moment called the Euclid mission, which has shown some slight curvature in the universe, how you have curvature in three dimensions. So we're talking higher dimensions here, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, beyond my pay grade. But it does it does predict that, and it predicts the current rate of expansion of the universe. And so basically, you know, this seems to be maybe a valid idea
that could
compete with the Big Bang. Doubtless people will start poring over this, and I'm sure some people will try and rip it to shreds because, you know, that's what you do with theories, especially when they're testable like that. And but it still leaves behind the big question, which for me anyway, what came before?
Yeah, what happened before the big bounce?
If you've got this thing that's busy sort of, you know, going in on itself, then where did that come from and what's that? So that seems to me a possible problem with this, but I don't know. I am not a quantum physicist, so we'll leave it to smarter minds than mine.
Yeah, interesting. You might be seeing big bounce make its way into textbooks in the future.
I do like the big bounce. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And this next thing, maths anxiety, something that we might all be familiar with. I'd hope we're familiar with at least the maths part. the anxiety around maths, how does this, what are we dealing with here?
Well, that's, you know, it's a very good question. And it just sort of seems that some people are good at maths and others aren't, don't you think? Well, I mean, would you describe yourselves as being good at maths?
No.
I was always pretty good at maths.
Yeah. So was I. I was good at maths, and then they introduced bloody letters into it. You know, when it was just numbers, and then you have these X's and Y's and things, you know. But I think that seems to be people's ideas, and once they get an idea in their heads that they're no good at maths, then that's it. They're, you know, and nothing you can say or do is going to change that. And so where does this come from? You know, why are people supposedly bad at maths? And so some workers at the University of Virginia wanted to answer this question. You know, are we inherently poor at maths? Is this something sort of that's ingrained in us or not? And so what they did was they got 109 children and they studied these children. So in second grade, third grade, fourth grade, okay, so basically second, third and fourth year of primary school over here, over several years. And what they were looking at, they were comparing what they call declarative memory skills,
ooh,
which is a fancy word for rote learning.
Ah, right.
Okay, so any type of learning that involves memory.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're comparing those in these children with skills that focus on problem solving, things that involve procedures and stuff like that. Not so much memory or anything, but maybe sort of, you know, doing things repeatedly or trying to figure things out and stuff like that. Because nowadays there's a big emphasis seemingly in pedagogy on problem solving skills. That seems to be the way that things are going, away from sort of the memory and the rote learning to sort of the doing. And so what they found, and this is extremely interesting, and I could absolutely believe this, that the declarative memory skills appear to be correlated with maths ability.
Right, that makes sense.
In other words, if you've got a good memory, then you're going to be good at maths, or you could be good at maths, let's say, okay? And so better memory skills in second grade meant better performance in maths at fourth grade.
Yeah, and that'd be things like your times tables, I'd imagine.
Oh, that's exactly it. Because, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I learned my times tables when I was at school. Did they still have them when you were
100%,
going through?
100%, yeah.
And actually, I found that, you know how we've got calculators anyway. I don't really need to memorize them because I'm probably a really terrible thing
to
say.
No, that is ridiculous.
But you're absolutely right.
I find that I'm using time savers all the time. I'm imagining how much time I've saved not having to pull out my calculator every time I need to do a time saver. I'm living maybe minutes in the future of everyone who's using a calculator every time.
So, you know, I find this very, very interesting, the fact that the times tables and stuff, those sorts of things are good for you, mathematically speaking, that they improve your performance.
Yeah.
In maths, if you've got the ability to do that sort of stuff, then you're going to be better at math, seemingly, is what these people are saying. So hopefully somebody in the Ministry of Education is listening and, you know, might follow up with the authors on this paper because, you know, maths is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And I see, you know, the biggest struggles that many students have at university when they come through and do chemistry is their maths.
Mm.
It absolutely is. And, you know, we've got to do better. We have to do better with maths. We just do. It's an essential part of life. Everyone needs to be numerate. They just do.
Yeah, and I've often said there could be better things done about getting everyone involved with maths and that sort of thing, because I feel like it's something that everyone can enjoy. There's just such a strong stigma around it in schools especially, but maths is fun.
Yeah, and you know, you don't want to get called a nerd or anything like that. I hear you.
Yeah. And then this last story, a Dutch silver basin. I did the math earlier, of converting
maths earlier. There we go.
Of converting it into New Zealand dollars. This is worth over 100 billion.
Well, not the actual thing itself.
Well,
this was their booty. Okay, so here's a wee history story for everybody out there. The year is 1628.
Wow, a while ago.
And there's a few Dutch boats travelling around Cuba, there or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And at the very same time, there was a Spanish fleet coming back, the Spanish treasure fleet. They were coming back from sort of Spanish America, which is sort of Central South America, with a cargo of gold, silver, spices, indigo, cochineal, things like that.
Everything expensive.
Oh, everything expensive. And this gets me. And so the Dutch were told, right, you've got to attack these guys and take all their booty,
right?
Basically.
Yeah.
Which they did with no bloodshed. So they just, you know, took them all and dropped them off on Cuba.
Took all the stuff.
And took all the stuff, which, get this, was worth, in today's money, 56.4 billion euros.
Yes.
Billion.
That's so that would be the number I converted. Yeah.
Which
over
is about
100 billion,
New Zealand dollars. 100
billion. Ridiculous amounts of money.
On boats, for God's sake, you know.
Think about a bank transfer, surely, or something like that.
And this is a big thing in Dutch history, apparently. They're very sort of proud of this. Mm. And so in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, they have what is purported to be two things that are made from the silver that was obtained in this raid. And one of them is a silver jug called an ewer, which I'd never actually heard.
It's a classic crossword word.
Obviously.
It was in a lot of good letters.
And a silver basin.
Mm.
Okay, and so some people in the Netherlands, some scientists over there, wanted to know the provenance of the silver in this, because these two things are touted as being made from the silver that came from this big raid. Okay, so how would they figure out where that silver came from? They look at lead, of course, because that's what you do. So
right.
Silver deposits are usually contaminated with a little bit of lead, and lead has these things called isotopes, which are very, very slightly different masses of the same atom. Okay, so we've got lead. And these isotopes are lead 204, 206, 207, 208. They just weigh a tiny little bit different from each other,
right.
Okay? And their abundances, the abundances of these isotopes depend on where you get the silver from.
Got it. Okay.
Okay?
So we can
You get silver from South America, it's going to have a different lead isotopic ratio than it will if you got it from Europe or whatever, bloody, bloody, blah. So cut to the chase. Basically, these folks were doing the lead analysis. And what they found was that the ewer, the jug, that was made from Mexican
Silver. Right. Certifiably from there.
Certifiably, absolutely. Yep. That's the correct isotope pattern, and they could say that absolutely definitely. However, the basin on which the jug was meant to rest and supposedly was meant to be made of the same stuff, oh no.
Ooh.
Oh no. So it's a mixture. So basically what would have happened is that all of the silver in the Netherlands would have been sourced from all over the place, and as it gets worked up and everything like that, it gets mixed, etc., etc. And so that then has an isotopic composition that is different from what you get if it was purely from South America, and it's just essentially a mixture. It comes out as being a mixture of European silver plus the silver from South America.
Guessing so, they didn't have enough.
Unfortunately to say, this is now, you know, it's not what they thought it was, let's say. So I don't know how that's going to change things at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, but, you know, this is nice. This is science in action. It really, really is very clever stuff. And this whole idea of provenance, you might think, oh, this is a bit, you know, silly, blah, blah, blah. But the same technique is used, for example, to make sure that, let's say, your New Zealand wine that you buy overseas is actually coming from New Zealand. Or your Manuka honey that you buy overseas actually comes from New Zealand. It's all to do with this isotopic analysis.
Very important
science. Absolutely fascinating. Wow. Ideas and very, very cool stuff.
So. Yeah, interesting demonstration of a technique we all rely on, I guess, especially here.
Yep.
Where our unique exports
exactly.
are so important.
And that's how we show that they're unique. So, yeah.
All right. Well, very interesting science stories you've shared with us today, Alan.
Yeah.
Thank you as always for coming in. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.